This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. I'm Sean Tubbs. We bring you now the fourth and final in a series of community conversations on poverty, sponsored by the Quality Community Council and the University of the Poor. This conversation was held on February 1st and centers on education and how a poor education or no education can factor into someone's likelihood to fall into poverty. The session is introduced by UVA Religious Studies Professor Corey Walker.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us this evening at the last of our community conversations. Hopefully, each of you have had an opportunity to sign up with us. Sign one of the information forms sponsored by QCC, because this is not the end but just the beginning of a long-range project to launch People's College, which is a cooperative grassroots educational initiative that will be the adult education arm of the Quality Community Council. And we'll be holding a series of informative meetings, information and organizational meetings later in the spring. And we need all of your contact information just in case any of you want to be involved in that venture. Undoubtedly, one of the most pressing issues on the public policy agenda is education. Education holds a sacred position in our individual and collective imaginations due to the promises and hopes it holds out for the intellectual and material advancement of the human condition. Unfortunately, it is because of this sacredness that our most intense public battles often occur around this issue. We need not look too far down the historical path to witness the intensity and the enormity of the battles over education, both locally and nationally. Indeed, because education means so much to how we conceive of who we are, what type of society we belong, and how we view one another and the world, we should properly engage in a vigorous conversation on the role and function of education in our democratic society. In this community conversation series on the persistence of poverty, we now begin to critically and openly confront the question of education in relation to the issue of poverty. Up to this point, we have indirectly approached this issue through our discussion of the nature of poverty, the relations of poverty in the built environment, and the question of poverty in light of the operations of our capitalist economic system. But now, we're going to directly engage the issue of education. And in so doing, we are forced to confront some of the deep-seated issues that are necessarily implicated in the question of poverty. Issues such as the structural and institutional dimensions of inequality, the critical linkages between the ways we think and the material reality of our everyday lives, the possibilities as well as the limits of our political institutions in addressing the issues of education and poverty, the challenges presented by the intense economic forces that work to commodify and instrumentalize education, the uncritical coupling of forms of education with particular ideas of race, class, and gender, and the intellectual acceptance and indeed the intellectual legitimation of poverty in an affluent society. In convening this conversation on the poverty of education, we are not under any illusions that we will solve the many problems that obtain in the nexus of poverty and education. Nor are we naive enough to believe that there is a single solution to this complex of issues. This is just another beginning of the many beginnings, both past and present, that seek to engage our community in a critical, reflective, and open conversation on one of the most pressing issues of our time. This is indeed a risk to tread in this obviously contentious area. However, this entire series has been a risk, for there is always a risk in challenging oneself to view the world in another manner. It is very much a risk to challenge ourselves to think the issues discussed in this series in relation to one another for we might just feel compelled to do something about the issue of poverty. And it is in the face of this very real risk that we may challenge ourselves and our fellow citizens to work tirelessly to end poverty. Let's take this risk to think and live otherwise.
Thanks for being here tonight. I wanted to share something that I heard through the grapevine about a greeting that the Maasai tribe in Africa use when they run into each other. And the greeting is not what you would think. You might have an image of the Maasai, and they're, if you don't, they're very ornately decorated people, and they often wear things that look aggressive. They look very powerful when you see a picture. And when they see each other, they greet each other with, "How are the children?" I think that's very telling. You wouldn't necessarily think it. You'd think someone might be drawing a line in the sand about property or roles and, you know, what the chain of command is, but they're not. They're looking at how are the children. And I think if we look now and talk about how are the children in our community, the resounding answer would need to be that Charlottesville's children are not all okay. Charlottesville's not a world-class city if you live in poverty. And as we've learned through these wonderful panels, the overwhelming majority of people living in poverty are working people. As you're probably aware, most of the low-income families living in Charlottesville are African Americans. There's quite a bit of data out there, and some of it is very shocking, about the racial inequities in the city schools. I wanted to share some of that with you. There are twice as many students who are white students as African Americans who are proficient in math. Less than half of the city's African American students are proficient in math. Charlottesville is in the bottom three school districts in the whole state in the achievement of African American students. We are below 130 other districts in reading, math, and science. These are other districts that are often very rural, very urban, do not have the kind of tax base that we have, and do not have the sort of school budget that we have. Charlottesville is among the 15 worst school districts for having a higher proportion of African American students who are getting special education services. The fancy word for this is disproportionality, and it's basically the flip side of what goes on with gifted education, where you see that there are very few African American students in the gifted and honors AP courses. In special education, they are very disproportionately represented. Last but not least, we have a real problem in the city with the graduation gap. The freshman class at CHS is about 400 students, but the graduating class is less than 200, and it doesn't catch up. It's not like it catches up the next year. It's that way consistently over time, and it's getting worse now that we have the high-stakes diploma requirements. Through my work at Just Children and with the Special Education Advisory Committee, I've seen two other big problems that really need to be addressed. There are a lot of low-income students who are getting special education services and being suspended because of challenging behavior. We don't just need to ask, how are the children? We also need to ask, where are the children? Once students are identified for special education, there are too many African American students being segregated into self-contained separate classrooms. We need to help students learn to solve problems, not punish them through exclusion. School discipline. School discipline is another similar issue where when you read the data, it's overwhelming. We're one of the most exclusive, most suspending and expelling school districts in our region. White families tell me that their children see that there is a racial bias in how rules are enforced in the city, and that has to change. Students who are suspended and expelled miss class time, further endangering their chances for success. In special education, the students who are in segregated classrooms don't usually get to access the general education curriculum, which means they don't even have a chance to pass SOL tests, which means they cannot get diplomas. Only 16% of the students with disabilities in the Charlottesville schools pass the 8th grade English SOL test. 16%, less than 1 in 5, but 2/3 of the students without disabilities passed. And the overwhelming majority of students with disabilities are not students who have significant cognitive issues. There are many, many students out there who have learning disabilities that should be able to be addressed and overcome and that can be adapted for on the SOL tests and accommodated. But we're seeing such a strong failure rate, and it's worse than it is in most of the rest of the state. People need to be heard. I'm not a person for talking without action, as most of you who know me. I want to cut to the move, just get things moving and make something happen. And I brought some flyers. Karen, if you're up for distributing, that'd be great. There are proposals coming before the school board that are pushed forward by the Special Education Advisory Committee, but they address not just the needs of students with disabilities, but how to help prevent more students who don't need the services, but who need some extra supports, or who might need to be given an extra chance to learn coping behaviors or anger management skills or whatever it might be. And these positions are for an inclusion specialist and a positive behavioral support specialist at Walker and Buford, which are where the transitions happen so rapidly in our system and where adolescence hits and frequently the school discipline problems just head through the roof. I hope that you'll take the time to share your opinion. The action alert has school board email addresses and phone numbers. Please get in touch with them and let them know that you support these positions and that you want things to improve for low-income children in the city. One recent study showed that the best way to raise student achievement is to address poverty. Only by abolishing inequities and poverty will we bring about broad, long-lasting change. We need to work toward that goal and grab a hold of issues that offer ways that we can move forward and build momentum. We need to build community leadership and organize to improve schools, housing, and fair wages. And last but not least, we need to have voter education and get out the vote to put people in office who will make the change happen. Thank you.
Good evening. I wrote a paper, but I forgot it. So I'm going to try to talk off the top of my head. I'm going to talk from the children's point of view. What I see in my neighborhood, can y'all hear me? Can you hear me now? Okay. I'm going to talk from a child's point of view. What I see with the kids is a lot of them start off in school having a hard time, because they are coming out of homes where they're single parents, and you have parents that things that y'all take for granted, like reading and writing, you have parents that can't read or write, so therefore if they can't help their kids with that work. So with the children that I deal with, a lot of them are having a hard time in school because a lot of them are not getting the proper rest, because of other things that's going on in the home. A lot of them, by the time they get to the school, they are tired, they are stressed out, because whatever the mom is going through, the child carries it on. You have children that is stressed out because the father has been removed from the home, and they are wondering, you know, when the father returns, whether they are going to stay. They are stressed out because they are living with aunts and uncles. They are stressed out because they are stereotyped in school. You have situations where I have talked to children, and there are things that's going on in the home that you can't even imagine. There are children that don't eat at night. So therefore, by the time it's time for them to go to school in the morning, they are hungry. A lot of them are not well rested. They are struggling. I'm seeing a lot of things that's going on. Bear with me because I'm new at this. But for the most part, it starts when they are young. It starts when they are young. When they have no one that's encouraging them. They have no one that's encouraging them because they are coming out of a home where there's other siblings. And a mom can't deal with all the children the way that, you know, society says she should. So what's happening is by the time they get to school at the age of 4, mentally they are a wreck. Mentally, they are struggling. Mentally, they are exhausted. I myself deal with a lot of children with a lot of issues. One of the things that I don't like that I'm hearing is how, if there are teachers in the audience, please don't do this to a child. How when a child misbehaves, you take that child and you separate that child in the classroom. And you point to that child and you say to that child, you don't want to be like him. You don't want to be like him. You don't need to hang around him because he's a bad influence. Then when that child starts feeling that inside and he starts acting on the words that people say to him, then people wonder why. People wonder why. What I want y'all to stop and think about, things that y'all take for granted, like getting a nice hot bath at night, a lot of kids don't get that. Eating at night, a lot of kids don't get that. To some kids, a bag of chips and a soda is their dinner. So by the time they get to school, they are tired. They're irritable. And I'm saying to the teachers in the room, you know the kids that's having a hard time. The only thing you have to do is use love, use a kind word. Sometimes even lay your hands on them and tell them that it's going to be all right. Because, you know, if you don't have people to encourage you, you struggle. You struggle through elementary school. You struggle through middle school. By the time you get to the high school, emotionally they are a wreck. And I'm asking y'all, please, please work with our kids. Because I see my children in my neighborhood getting put out of school for silly things. Things that I know that they can deal with in school. I see them, they come to me and they talk to me about how they ask for help from the teachers. And the teachers say things like, you figure it out. Or you try to work it out. And the child is saying, I don't understand. Can you help me? I see that. I hear the stories. And then you wonder why they drop out once they get to Charlottesville High School. You wonder why? Think about this tonight when you lay down. Think about this once you get home and you eat your meal. There are some kids that's not going to eat tonight. There are some kids that's not going to take a bath tonight. There are some kids that have to worry about whether somebody is going to touch them in the middle of the night. There are some kids that's having a struggle within themselves. You look at four-year-olds and you say, well, you know, he's only four. You can't imagine what some of these four-year-old children have gone through. You know, people say, well, you know, you should read to your child. A lot of them can't read. The parents can't read, so you can't teach what you don't know. And I'm asking y'all as a community, please band together. Please work with our children. Come into our community. We have a community center. Come in. Come in and interact with our kids so we won't have our kids dropping out. And I say this, and I always say this to the young black males in my neighborhood, I feel for you because they have no role models. They have no role models. They take on the job of being the head of the household, which they shouldn't have to, but they're being told that by other males that's in the neighborhood. You're a man now. Then when they start acting like a man, going out doing things to support their family, people want to know why. I'm saying to y'all tonight, please, whatever you do, take time out. Say a kind word to the children when you see them in school. If you see, and y'all know the kids that's struggling, you know. You know, I'm looking at my grandson back there because he has a hard time, not because he can't learn. Because I feel that they need to find a different way of dealing with him other than putting him out. Send him to the suspension center for 10 days. That doesn't do him any good. And the least little thing he do, you know, they put him out the classroom. I mean, 1 day, 2 day, 3 days, that adds up. And I'm asking y'all to let's stick together. Let's educate our kids. work with me because I'm in my community center and I'm trying to do the best that I can. Work with me. You know, we need tutors in my neighborhood. We need people to come in. We need people to work with these children. So I'm asking, please come in. Please help, because I'm tired of seeing the children in my neighborhood either at the suspension center, either in the court system. Anytime you take a child and you threaten at 10 years old to say that you're going to have to take him to court because of a behavioral problem, that's what you call it, a behavioral problem. But I'm just saying sometimes kids get a little bored with the way they're teaching them. But anyway, anytime you take a child and you threaten to take him to court because of a behavior problem, knowing that he has something that happened in his life, that's wrong. And I'm saying, what's wrong with our school system? When you're kicking kids out of because of clothes that they're wearing, when you're kicking kids out because of where they live, and then when they start acting accordingly, then you wonder what's wrong? Stop telling our kids that they're not going to be anything. Stop telling them. Stop comparing them. I see that. I go to the school. You know, you can't compare a child. You know, if you want to talk to a child, pull them to the side. You don't do it in front of the class. And it bothers me. It bothers me with some of the things that I'm seeing with the children. So for the teachers in the audience, when you see a child acting up, say a kind word. Don't call home just when they acting up. Call home to tell me they had a good day. You know? Reward them. Reward them for that behavior, that good behavior. I mean, if you can take time out to call me to tell me, you know, how this child showed up in your classroom today, and then this child can come home and tell me he had 3 good days, and some people said, well, 3 good days? What is 3 good days? To a child that's struggling, 3 good days is like 3 good years. Okay? So, come into my community. I'm a member of South First Street. I need tutors. It doesn't matter whether you're a teacher or what. Please come in to my community. Help me with my kids, because we want all of our kids to graduate. We don't want to see any more kids in the system. Thank you.
Good evening. Is this okay? Am I all right? Wow, Ms. Gilmore, that was a tough act to follow, I tell you. But what I would like to do, I would like to share a story with you. And the story comes from my research. I did research with African-American males who have been successful with school mathematics. And so this story is within that context. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to read the story to you, and then we'll go from there. The story is about Calvin. Calvin is a sixth grade boy. He's the oldest of 3 children. He lives in a single family home with his mother. Actually, not a single family home. He lives with his mother and his grandmother and his brother and sister, but he's the oldest. So here's Calvin's story. Calvin is the sixth grade African American male student in a school district located in the southeastern part of the United States. As an elementary school student, Calvin earned the highest level achievement on his state standardized mathematics tests in grades 3, 4, and 5. In addition, he scored in the 98th percentile on the Iowa test of basic skills in mathematics. On all objective measures, Calvin has performed well, and in most cases, he has excelled. In addition, he has earned relatively good grades in mathematics by earning A's and B's. Calvin stated that mathematics is his favorite subject and that math comes naturally to him and is very easy. He loves challenging math problems and loves mathematics puzzles. Calvin's mother acknowledged that her son needs a variety of stimulation in order to prevent boredom. She also stated that Calvin needs to feel that his teachers are interested in him and care about him and for him to be productive in class. Both Calvin and his mother admit that he can be a handful in class. His behavior is not always that of a model student. However, his behavior is well within the acceptable norms of the classroom. At the end of fifth grade, Calvin was excited about going to middle school. At that time, teachers identified students who were eligible to take a mathematics placement test to gain entry in an upper-level mathematics class for sixth graders. Calvin was upset because he was not selected, and there were students who were selected that were not as good at math as he was. Calvin's mother inquired about the criteria for selection. She discovered that Calvin met all the criteria except for one, teacher recommendation. Calvin's fifth grade teacher indicated that although Calvin scored well on assessments, his behavior and his inability to sit still would not make him a good candidate for the class. In a conference with the middle school guidance counselor, Calvin's mother inquired about him being placed into the math class. The guidance counselor responded that she would not want to place Calvin in a class that he would not pass and did not consider his previous performance. The principal at the middle school evaluated Calvin's situation. The principal argued that the math class is rigorous for sixth graders and that only disciplined students are capable of passing this class. Even though Calvin had performed well in mathematics throughout his schooling, school personnel focused their attention on his behavior rather than his academic achievement when evaluating his academic potential. When the school year began, the class had no African American males. Thank you.
We're off number, that's why. Okay. Good evening, everyone. Please forgive me, I get a little long-winded. I do talk a little light. I also got pneumonia, but I'm here tonight. Okay, I'm going to be as quick as possible, but everyone here who knows me knows that I'm compassionate. I'm very passionate about what I say. I'm going to hit a quick couple of topics that I want you guys to chew on. And these are some of the things that I see in our educational system that really affect the poor, whether you be black or white. We have an educational deficit. The main cause of the achievement gap is the educational deficit. When social and economic disparity is a direct association with the rate of failure and low performance among students of low economic means. Prejudice. When students who are often low economic means and disparity aren't given the same chance for education because of their residential locations or economic or social standing. Burnout. Many of our educators, due to stress and strain of the profession, meet with burnout or fatigue, often because there are not programs of sabbatical or leave available, and I mean paid leave. Non-inclusiveness. It is evident by lack of parent-teacher communications and feedback, as well as student interaction, is sadly lacking and is more prevalent among lower economic students. Lack of common sense approach. The lack of common sense approaches to educating our lower income students is the biggest hurdle to overcome and often leaves the majority of these students without a basic educational skill they will need for the future. Something that really touched me, and being that this is Black History Month, I'm going to talk to my minority people real quick. I want to talk to you about some Old Bay seasoning and being crabs. Because something I realized in our educational system, especially amongst our minority students, unlike when I was coming up and we could look at our minority educators and they would help us. They would lead us because they wanted us to make something of ourselves. I've seen what's called the crab effect. We don't want you to get any higher than us. Well, I got news for you. I want you to become better than me and reach higher than me.
So whenever anyone pulls you down, if you ever need someone to talk to, I will be there to support you because I want you to outdo me. But those are for our minority students. Now, for everybody else, we have some serious problems. I've heard our politicians say one thing and do just the direct opposite. You say that you understand and you want education and you want to help the low class and the minority community get that proper and decent education. But yet and still your actions prove just the opposite. You will not let us be in the decision-making process. You keep us out of your parties. You do not come to our neighborhoods. You do not ask us who are directly affected, what do we need to do to make this better? Therefore, you will never succeed. Yet and still, our percentage ratio in high school, it is shown that with the exception of Clark, once our kids get to upper elementary schools, they start failing. Once our minority kids get to upper elementary school, they start dropping out of programs such as BAN. We have some serious issues here. We can talk about it, or we can start doing action. For those of us who are low income, we need to realize that we are people too. We have minds. Don't be afraid to elect someone from your own background. Don't be afraid to put someone from your own background up there. We have some issues about those of us with educations and a little bit of money. We'll do what we need to do to make ourselves feel better. But realistically, we are a little bit better than you are. That's a problem. You will never resolve these issues. You know, you go to church an hour on Sunday, but the rest of the week, you sin all day. That's a problem. And it's the same thing with education. Because you have a doctorate degree means you know more than Jenny down the street who's raising her three kids by herself. You got problems. Because Jenny down the street knows why her son can't read because he don't bring home a grammar book. You can't read if you don't know grammar. You can read all the words, but you don't get the context. We have some serious issues. And education will always suffer. The educational system has gotten worse because we've moved away from the basics because we want to try all these new approaches. The new approaches aren't working, and our kids are the ones that are suffering. And the only way to stop that, because I don't know how many of you, one question, because I like to know this. How many of you are poor? 30,000 and below, honey, 30,000 and below, you are poor. Because 20% of your income will go to taxes. Gas pump, wherever, Fed's going to get theirs, state's going to get theirs. How many of you are under 30,000? Not trying to find out your business because I am. I tell you right now, I looked in the refrigerator 3 days ago, I only had 2 jugs of water. And people say, well, why didn't you say something to me? America has pride. I have pride. Our children have pride. Our children will sit there and not understand something, but they're too proud to ask because they don't want you to think they're dumb. Our children will come to you and give you hints, but half of our teachers will not stay after school 45 minutes, which is in their contract too. I went to open house, parents' night at the high school. I expected that if I can make it there and parents can make it there, parents who got on the bus to make it there were there. I expected the teachers to be. Yet to my dismay, 2 major teachers were not there. How can you teach my child if you won't take the time out to know me when I have made that up? I'm not going to lie to you. We got problems and we've got issues. And sitting here sugarcoating it, making sure it was everything is fine, is not the answer. I must say one thing on a very important educational issue that happened. Because the people voted to have an elected school board to give fair representation. I must say the decision that recent decision by council to make it at large only hurt those in the poor community. Because most of them cannot afford to run to try and make a difference. When you take away that from them and you let them know that they are less than you, you've just ruined any chance you had. So I'm going to leave you, because I got to go home and take my meds, but I'm going to leave you with an idea. And I want to leave you with something to think about. And you think about it good, real good. We are becoming a sad society, a society where money is everything. Greed, as they say, for lack of a better word, is not good, but it's bad. Because greed means we're so busy trying to get ahead, we're forgetting those of us who are left behind. So before we pull out the old bay seasoning, and it's just not minorities that do that, it's everyone. Let's remember, we don't need to be crabs. We should be helping each other succeed. That's the only way to make this country better. It's the only way to make this country strong. It's the only way to save this society. It's to help one another. Let's all climb out of the basket of despair together. And don't pull me back. Don't pull my child back. Don't pull anybody's child back. Strengthen our educational system. For those of you, go to the school board meetings. Make a difference. For you, those of you parents, go to the classes with your kids. Administrators, teachers, let the parents come in and sit in class with the kids. Let's correct this situation together, or it won't be corrected at all.
Okay, can y'all hear me? Okay. I think that what I'm going to do with my remarks is just pull the camera lens. Whoops. Pull the camera lens back a little bit. We've been hearing some really moving testimony from our parents. No? How's this? How's this? Okay. I can't hear it, so. We've been hearing some really moving testimony from our parents. We've been getting great statistics from other members of our community. I want us to talk a little bit and think a little bit about the place where we live, because we're very accustomed to the Charlottesville of today, the place that we think of as open and tolerant and highly educated. But there's another Charlottesville that's behind that Charlottesville that we often do not focus on. So there's four points that I want to make about education, and these are points that we're miseducated about, we're misinformed about, but these are points that are sort of drawn from our history as a community, and I'm going to pull out some research that I did many, many years ago when I first moved back to Charlottesville to go to graduate school, to let you hear what people said at that time in their own words about these issues. So the first point that I want to make is that historically, and sometimes still today, African Americans and other people who have not traditionally had access to the goodies of society experience education in a way that's very different from the way the dominant society experiences it. They experience education as a counter to oppression, a tool that you can use to your own self-development and self-liberation. I'll give you two examples, both historical. The first comes from way, way back in our history, Peter Fawcett, who was enslaved on Monticello Plantation. As some of you may know, Jefferson only freed five of his slaves upon his death. One of them was Peter Fawcett's father, Joe. Peter was one of the youngest children. And he already knew how to read, but Joe Fawcett was freed, but his entire family was sold off in the estate sale that followed Jefferson's passing. And so Joe and his had to go to work basically to gather the money to start buying his family out of slavery immediately after being freed. Peter was a young boy at the time. He went to live at a neighboring plantation that was owned by one Captain Jones, who discovered to his dismay that Peter could read and was showing other kids on the plantation how to read also. And he threatened him with 9 and 30 lashes on your back if I ever catch you again. So Peter Fawcett, you know, immediately his response was to start gathering people at night and teaching them to read. When he managed 20 years later to get out of slavery and had tried many times to buy himself out but wasn't able to do it, his family had gone to Ohio ahead of him. Finally, some friends of the Jefferson family felt so badly about the situation that they helped Peter Fawcett to buy his freedom 20 years later. He went to join his family in Ohio, Cincinnati, where they had started a catering company, and there he became a reverend. He became a member of the Underground Railroad, and he was active in a number of, you know, civic and civic organizations and activist organizations in Ohio. So for Peter Fawcett, education was definitely a tool to counter oppression. Another example that we have is Jim Trice, whom some of you may know. He was one of the first African-Americans to graduate from the University of Virginia. I see Paul Gaston nodding and waving his hand. Jim Trice matriculated at the university 1957 to 1962. He came to the University of Virginia back in this period when African-Americans were not allowed in the College of Arts and Sciences, because the law at that time was that if your program was offered at a black university, you had to attend that university. And so he came in, you know, with a group of about 5 or 6 other young men through the side door of the engineering program. So because the engineering program, engineering was offered nowhere at a black university in Virginia. So these young men had to be admitted. So they went to the chair. They were all chemists, and they wanted to transfer into the College of Arts and Sciences. So they went to the chair of the chemistry department at that time, a Dr. Hubbard. And he said he would be happy to help them transfer. His exact quote was, "That's why they built that school for your people down in Petersburg," speaking of Virginia State University. When they explained to him that they were not interested in VSU, that they wanted to be in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Virginia, Hubbard's response was, "Those doors will never be open to you." So there were 3 young men who were in that meeting. One of them became an activist and went out and gathered support, and he was one of the key people who was instrumental in opening the doors to the college. The other became dismayed and discouraged, and he dropped out, eventually transferred to another school and got a PhD in chemistry at American University. But he never recovered from, that confrontation with the department chair. Jim Trice's response was to put his head down. He said, "I said if it took me years, I was going to graduate from the University of Virginia." So for him, too, this was a response to oppression and a tool to overcome oppression. Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two is one that not very many people are familiar with. We are accustomed to thinking of Reconstruction governments in the South as, you know, the sort of birth of a nation stereotype. This orgy of misrule and oppression of white people. In fact, free, universal public education was a product of Reconstruction governments in the South. As W.E.B. Du Bois said in his masterwork, Black Reconstruction, public education for all at public expense was, in the South, a Negro idea. So that is something that we need to keep in mind also, that we wouldn't have the structure of universal public education that we have now had it not been for black and white Republicans working together in those governments. And here's where we run into problems, because as a community, we have difficulty admitting, understanding, facing the fact that whites actively resisted this notion of free universal public education. They gradually came around to the idea of it for all white men. E.A. Alderman after whom, you know, for whom Alderman Library is named, is one of the people who championed that notion. But to get the idea of how this was viewed for blacks, we have to turn to the words of Paul Barringer. You guys have heard of the Barringer Wing at the library. He was the dean of the UVA faculty. He also owned 1,600 acres of agricultural land in the county and was a noted eugenicist of the time. Barringer's response was, "Shall we, having by a great effort gotten rid of the Negro as a political menace, deliberately proceed to equip the Negro of the future as an economic menace?" And he added, "The public schooling of this people should primarily be a Sunday school training." You know, these are the leaders after whom many of our great buildings are named here at the university. Here's another idea that we're not accustomed to, that the Yankee schoolmarm and the Northern philanthropists who helped with the education of the Negro in the South actively colluded with the Barringers to make this a Sunday school training. They created the idea of industrial education, which was pioneered at many institutions, but here at Virginia by at Hampton Institute by General Samuel Armstrong Chapman. He was the son of missionaries, had grown up in Hawaii. And his quote on industrial education and how it was applied at Hampton University was, "A good labor record has often saved one from being dropped as incompetent, while one brilliant in studies is sometimes sent away for inefficiency in the shop or farm." To what degree have we inherited that way of thinking and that structure of educating our children here in the Commonwealth? Now, let's talk a little bit about the UVA of that time. The UVA students, for example, I think that it's really great. You get a really great picture in the words of, in their own words. When we look at the UVA students, when they talk about their concerns and what they thought was important. Here's a great little quote. See if I can find it. Well, I'm sorry, I'm looking on the wrong page. Can't find it right now. One of the most interesting quotes that I found was from Corks and Curls, which was the alumni, you know, the alumni, the yearbook of that times. And there's a great quote in the 1918 Corks and Curls from a young man who is talking about the joy of coming back to campus and being able to snap his fingers and order his man about, that man, you know, who would have been African American, and having the younger boys on the yard look at him with admiration to see what it really meant to be a Virginia gentleman. When we look at the way they were viewed by the young men who integrated the University of Virginia, they didn't come off in such glorious terms, the students of the university. Remember that as early as 1928, UVA had a reputation as being the hardest drinking school in the nation. In 1934, the university had to adopt more stringent housing regulations after students moved two prostitutes into one of the dorms with the predictable results that 50 cases of venereal disease. Early black students who integrated the university were from, you know, their equivalent of middle class and, you know, and elite families in the black community, but they had they came to this process of integration with a high moral purpose. They were completely repelled by what they saw, the drinking, the Animal House style pranks, the, you know, innocent hijinks to the really frightening and violent incidents that they were exposed to. One of the people that, who was a product of those early years is Wesley Harris, whom some of you may know very well also. Wesley Harris was the first African-American student to live on the lawn. He was a member of the Jefferson Society, a brilliant debater, went on to MIT, became one of the most, the foremost aeronautics professors in the United States. And his response was to look at the university. He said that he never saw anything that he could describe as a Virginia gentleman. What he saw was drinking and whoring, and, you know, it was extremely repellent to his sensibilities. So, you know, we need to step back, look at the historical record of the time to see what we have inherited. We have this mythology that is what we think that the university is about, but there are other facts behind this mythology that challenge that view. So I haven't mentioned anything in all of this about poverty. And the point that I want to make about poverty is that in this context in which we have inherited these institutions and structures of oppression that are, you know, below the tolerant and the open veneer that this university has become over the years and that this city has become over the years, they are still there. Their lineaments are still there, sort of like in the shadows. People in poverty are those who have the fewest resources to deal with understanding and navigating their way through these structures of oppression. Last year, we had a long debate over the schools and what needed to happen in the schools. And I was dismayed to see that discussion get bogged down in discussions of individual personal racism. When what we are talking about is not the actions of individuals, what we are talking about is structures of oppression that we as individuals are failing to challenge. So when you look at a situation now in which African-American people are people who have always, throughout our history, seen education as the tool to liberation, where now in the schools, our poor children feel that education is the tool of their oppression. We have to figure out why that is and how we can turn that around. So that's what I wanted to leave you with today. Thank you. It's coming. Hang on.
Good evening. I'm sure you'll agree that we've heard some extraordinarily powerful observations by the previous speakers. I know that I certainly have been enlightened by what I've heard. And having been in Charlottesville only 3 months, I'm hardly in a position to offer you any insights that could be useful to you about what might be done in this school system. I have, however, in my few years in the higher education arena, had the opportunity to live in a number of places around the country and have experienced what I think certainly is one of the best school systems in the country and one of the worst school systems in the country. I lived for 10 years in Raleigh, North Carolina. My children attended school there in the Wake County school systems, and I do believe that those experiences for them were extraordinarily rich and meaningful. Some of the things that are happening in that school system perhaps could be done in Charlottesville. Some of them may not fit. But I need to tell you about one experience with my younger daughter that I think to this day I still believe to be the best experience in K-12 education I have seen. My daughter attended public school in Raleigh, North Carolina, and she was in a program in which at the very first day of school, she was involved in a process of elective courses and changing classes. This is a first grade student. So she brought home her curriculum guide, and we helped her select a series of elective courses every semester. One course in science, one course in math, one course in foreign languages, course in dance, course in music, and a course in civics. And this was the thrust of the curriculum. Every semester, she would have a different set of courses grounded in those subjects. Every day, she would change classes in her school to go from one class to another.
Excuse me.
Okay. Thanks. Sorry. Every day, she and every other student in the school would change classes to go from one place to another in order to receive the instruction. So this meant that when she left homeroom in the morning, she and the other 25 students in her classroom, first grade, went to different sections of the building. She went to class 6 for her course in French. The young girl that sat next to her went to room number 9 for a course in Spanish and so forth. Now, there were some very interesting observations that came out of that. The content was important. We were obviously concerned as parents about what she was taking away in terms of the skills that she was developing. But we realized after a while that more than the content, what she was learning was confidence and self-reliance. Simply by negotiating the building at 6 years old, she began to get an understanding of her own sense of ability to negotiate complex environments. As she began to understand principles of science and foreign language and so forth, she began to get an understanding of her own capabilities. And so over the course of the time that she was there, my wife, who is by training a primary school teacher, considers it to have been a significant part of the development for our daughter, that in turn we consider to have been the best educational experience that we've seen in the country. By contrast, I came to Charlottesville from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, where, in fact, the state of public education is at best abysmal. There are poor physical facilities, an incoherent curriculum, way too few dedicated teachers, and the outcomes are exactly what you would expect. The children who go through that school system are, in fact, at the very, very bottom of the ranking in the nation in terms of their capabilities. So what's the difference from one school system to another? Perhaps leadership, perhaps perspectives. One of the things that I remember very specifically about the situation in Raleigh was the motto in the school that my daughter attended. Over the school, entrance to the school was a banner that said, "Every student matters, every day is important." And what they did in that school and in that system was to establish high expectations of their students and hold them to those expectations, infuse science, math, and technology into the curriculum for every student, connect with and support the adults and parents in the communities and invite them into the school, encourage and facilitate group learning and group instruction, and to reward the accomplishments of students at every possible opportunity. I don't know necessarily that those factors will be ones that would make a difference in the Charlottesville school system, but I think there are principles that we ought to think about applying in every school for every student. My guess is over a period of time, they will indeed make a difference. Thank
you. I want to thank all our speakers tonight. I have learned a tremendous amount, and one of the things that I have learned is this constant relationship between the individual and the structure. The individual and the structure. Emily gave us a picture of our structure, which needs a lot of help for many, many children. We had a picture from Dr. Barry about how silently one individual, one teacher, can silently cut a student out of a whole process of learning. Deirdre brought up for us the power of individuals to reduce a child's stress or to raise a child's stress when they're learning. Kenneth talked about the power of wanting good for others. What it is as a community to want better for people rather than to want to keep them down. Kendra talked about the structure in the broadest historical sense of what it is to be kept from learning by historic structures. And Mr. Harvey brought them all together with his daughter individually flourishing when the structure is in place for her to learn and for her to grow. That's what I learned tonight about this constant relationship between the structure and the individual.
In our thinking around this series, we come to understand that in as much as we'd like to, the focus is on children, and there's indeed an intense focus on K through 12 education. If we don't have a corollary component in terms of a vigorous adult educational program, then it actually defeats, it actually serves as a detriment to full and robust, effective K through 12 education. In a city the size of Charlottesville, with its educational facilities, both with a strong university, research university, and a strong community college, we should have an equally robust adult educational program in and around the area. Most of our adult education is centered around English as a second language. Instead of a robust, full curriculum around arts, sciences, and also instructional and technical education. We do have the technical component with K-Tech, as well as with other adult programs that are housed out of Albemarle High School and through the area. But yet there's not a synthesis around these and focusing with an intense focus, rather, on those low-income, impoverished areas in our city. This is what People's College is attempting to address. It is to address that deficiency such that we can train individuals in terms of education, adult education, and they in turn serve as catalysts for their children. If we look at the access question, how do impoverished areas or impoverished citizens access not only K through 12 education, but also K through 12 through 16 education, then I think that's where we have another gap. We have PVCC, but a few years ago in the mid-90s, I was involved with an effort through Deborah DeCroce, who was former president at PVCC, with the PVCC UVA Neighborhood Center. That was run under the late John Baker. John Baker was a real catalyst in terms of catalyzing that particular space to serve as a gap to offer classes to the local community in and around the Jefferson School area, as well as to serve as a bridge between classes at PVCC and eventually courses at the University of Virginia. With that gap missing, we need to actually refill that gap and then think of strategic ways we can then intervene in opening up access to non-traditional students at the university. One thing that I did since coming to the university, I've worked with the Bachelor of Interdisciplinary Studies program, which is a new initiative undertaken by the university in adult education. However, there still are a number of barriers for full access in that program. If we think of another institution that has revamped its continuing ed program, an institution like Northeastern University in Boston, where the continuing ed program has its own faculty and they offer a number of classes, the majority of them at night, then I think there are some areas where the university we can actually grow and develop a much more robust engagement in education to help alleviate the issue of poverty, and also begin to bridge the gap between community college systems and four-year colleges. Now, I say all this, and you can find all this in any number of politicians' handbooks or any number of college mission statements. But there's an underlying problem that we must begin to encounter. Or we must begin to engage. And that is the very simplistic equation that if we have education, everything will be all right. Education equals employment. Education equals equality. Education will equal a fundamentally sound social structure. As we've learned through these conversations, it is a very complex issue that we're confronting. And it's not only education, it's a wonder. It's amazing that you can have a very smart individual who may not be credentialed, but then that individual who may be a felon becomes unemployable. And now with felons having to identify themselves as such to actually access higher education, that in and of itself becomes a problem. I actually had an incident with a state senator about a student with a felon record. And it was very problematic in terms of trying to keep that student in school here locally. But that student was one of the most outstanding students I've taught in my entire career at the University of Virginia. So these issues are not separate, and they are complex. So what we ask for citizens is to begin to engage in a robust conversation on this
and to begin to think about all of the issues that we've brought up in throughout this series and that you're aware of, and then say, well, how do we make this better? What are some of the beginning steps that we can encourage to try to change our society? There is no one silver bullet, but I think together we can all try to change how we engage this particular problem. Education is a key, but it is not the only key.
It struck me that this poem very well embodies where education and poverty often come to a crossroads. It's written by Tony Cordell, listed as a new reader. It's entitled, I Could Get By, But Not Ahead. I could read well enough to get through school, but not get an education. Read well enough to identify words, but not well enough to follow directions. Appeared normal on the outside, but unable to stop the heavy feeling of stupid on the inside. I was handed a high school diploma, but couldn't retain the knowledge. Still, I could read well enough to read 3 Dr. Seuss books to my children, but not well enough to help them with their homework. Sure, I could get by. I read well enough to purchase a can of tuna instead of a can of cat food, but not well enough to follow a recipe to prepare the tuna creatively. I could read well enough to get a job, but not well enough to have a career. I could read well enough to see the difference between various prescriptions, but not well enough to understand articles about the benefits of nutrition. I could read well enough to sign my name to legal papers, but not well enough to understand that I was giving up all possessions, a house, a car, a ski boat, and a pickup. Those papers also said that I was an unfit mother, so custody of my 2 children was innocently signed away when legal documents held up in the court. Oh, yes, I could get by, but not ahead.
You've been listening to the 4th and final community conversation on poverty, the poverty of education, sponsored by the Quality Community Council and the University of the Poor. Opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and not of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network or Wordcast Productions. I'm Sean Tubbs. Thanks for listening.